there is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. So today, we will be looking at a number of the models predicting the eventual fate of the universe. As you can imagine, this is a fairly complex topic, so we will be joined today by Dr. Paul M. Sutter, an astrophysicist with Ohio State University. It is also quite a long topic, so this will be a two-part episode, and you can watch part two over on Paul's channel, which is also an excellent place to visit to learn more about cosmology in general. To discuss the end of the universe, we might as well start with the beginning, both where it came from and how human thought on this matter has evolved as we learned more. The Big Bang theory was proposed almost a century ago and has solidified its status since then, but people have been thinking about the origin of the universe for at least as long as we've had recorded history. They obviously didn't have the same resources we have nowadays, but typically drew three basic conclusions that remained popular up to modern times. Since the world around them could be seen to change on a daily basis, but not necessarily all that much or significantly, they tended to conclude either the universe at one point did not exist, or it has always existed and changes are cyclical, like the sunrise or turning of seasons, or that at a grand scale it pretty much doesn't change at all. Which is to say, snow may fall or melt on a mountain, trees might grow on it and die, but the mountain is unchanged and so is the world it sits on. It's easy for us to look back to antiquity and how little they knew about science and dismiss their thoughts on this topic, but it still lays out the conversation we've had in more modern times and are still discussing. If the universe began, then how did that happen? Who acted or what occurred to make that happen, and what came before? If there was something before, was it like now and are we just repeating things in an endless cycle like the seasons? And if it has always been around, how is it getting renewed? Because you can look at the forest on a mountain changing and say it changes but the mountain does not, but eventually you will notice that the mountain gets eroded, rain comes down and washes dirt away, and while you can see water evaporate and rise into clouds, you can also see rocks tumble down a mountain but never float back up. Talking about how these things began inevitably leads to asking how they will end. Will everything just keep being renewed constantly or reset in some cycles, or just wear down one day? Needless to say, folks had a lot of notions for how things would begin and end, and they did tend to fit into one of those three options, even if the specific theory was that Earth was a disk riding around on the back of a turtle shell or elephants. With the emergence of formal logic and philosophy, we've got quite a few appearing. Aristotle suggested that the universe was finite in size, centered on Earth, but infinite in time. This geocentric model would later be refined by Ptolemy and stick around till Copernicus, though even in Aristotle's time, a heliocentric model had emerged from Aristarchus, and interestingly, Archimedes had calculated the universe to be a light year in radius. It is, of course, far larger than that, but it's worth remembering how shockingly huge that is. Archimedes had no idea what speed light traveled at, but he knew how big that distance he'd calculated was, and it meant he thought the universe was a billion times wider than the planet, and contained a billion, billion, billion times the volume. We now know it's at least several billion times wider than even that, but it meant even then they'd come to realize just how tiny Earth was, even if they gave it center stage. This doesn't get covered much, but it should be, as Archimedes' calculation of this in his paper, The Sand Reckoner, is considered to be the first research expository paper, and actually used Aristarchus' heliocentric model. We knew the sun moved in the sky, as did the planets. That's the origin of their name, as planet means wanderer. We also had discovered the concept of parallax by then, and the stars didn't seem to experience it. Indeed, it would be 2,000 years before Frederick Bessel first successfully measured the parallax of a star in 1838.
Archimedes, Aristotle, Ptolemy, and Aristarchus were all wrong, of course, but Copernicus wasn't actually right, and indeed, since we can see equally far in all directions, the observable universe is actually centered on Earth and geocentric. But that's a fairly irrelevant status. Every observer is centered in their observable bubble. We don't want to get in the habit of thinking, though, that Copernicus was smart and right and arguing that his predecessors and opponents were stupid and wrong. Rather, they were quite smart too, and Copernicus was just less wrong. As we go through these theories, which each radically alter how we view the universe as we get some new piece of evidence, only to be replaced sometime later as we got new evidence, we do not want to view the advocates of the previous theories as drooling morons arguing against their clear illuminating light of reason and evidence. So prior to Copernicus, the main theory was the universe was infinite in age, or if not, had been created at some point more or less as it was now and would continue on as it was, but also finite if huge in size, although nowhere as big as we currently understand it. Over the next century, his modified form of this started catching on, but took a hit when Newton's law of universal gravity both cemented the heliocentric model, providing a mechanism to explain the motion of the planets, but also kind of killed it.
If every body in the universe exerts gravity on each other, then they ought to fall together over time. And needless to say, if the universe was infinitely old, there has been more than time enough for that. So from Newton's work, we were faced with four possible solutions. First, the universe is not infinitely old, and appeared at some point all spread out and is falling in. This gives us a potential fate of the universe, backwards of the Big Bang, that it began huge and will end when everything eventually slams together. Second, that gravity is not an entirely inverse square force, but gets even weaker at great distances, so that we are not pulling on those stars. Indeed, this option has remained a common theory until modern times, and we see it in something called MND, Modified Newtonian Dynamics, one of the popular explanations for dark matter until very recently. If gravity basically just ceases at some distance, then you don't have to worry about stars falling together. Third, that something is holding those stars from falling together, resisting gravity, akin to the old notion of angels holding them on a celestial sphere. This was never too popular, and amusingly, the discovery of dark energy pushing the universe apart makes this the only one of the four interpretations to still have some validity nowadays. And fourth, that the universe is infinite in both age and size, or at least size. 16th century mathematician and astronomer Thomas Diggs first suggested this one, that the stars were not at a fixed distance on a shell, but spread out over varying distances all the way out to infinity, what is now called the static universe model. He also first noticed the dark night sky paradox, later known as Orbital's paradox, even though Orbital wouldn't be born for a couple more centuries. If everything is spread out over an infinite volume, then nothing is moving because there's always more stuff in the opposite direction pulling it that way too. This one gained a lot of traction, and its main flaw was the aforementioned Orbital's paradox, which points out that in an infinite universe, any specific direction you look will eventually be obstructed by a star. So the night sky shouldn't be black with a few lights twinkling in it, but a uniform shade of light. We'd be surrounded by stars and feel like we lived inside a massive sun. Indeed, were that the case, everybody should be burned to death, and if the universe were not infinitely old. As Roma discovered, light needed time to travel and its approximate speed in 1676. So we could predict that the eventual doom of the universe would be the sky getting brighter and brighter as ever more distant light arrived until we eventually burned to death. Each of these perspectives had a lot going for it, and against it, in the 17th century and on to the 18th. As we move into the 19th century, though, we had a few new developments. We had begun to assume stars were not all fixed on some sphere, and that the Earth did not orbit the Sun, so we could use that movement to engage in some very wide parallax measurements. As mentioned, Bessel managed to get the first measurement of a distance to a star, 61 Cygni, in 1838, and two of his contemporaries, Struve and Henderson, managed to do the same for Vega and Alpha Centauri at about the same time. We managed to measure around 100 more in short order, but couldn't for many others. We can see a lot more stars than that with the naked eye and had telescopes by now, so this inability to measure them told us they were very far away. We had another development in this period too, which was thermodynamics. Energy is conserved, but entropy is not. We had no idea what made the stars hot yet, but we knew they were and should be cooling down, and that if they weren't, they were presumably being fueled some way, and that fuel should be finite. We already had a lot of philosophical arguments for why the universe couldn't be infinite in age, but we also had the same problems for why it couldn't be finite either. But thermodynamics and the speed of light piled on to make this much harder. If the universe is infinite in size and age, then we should be cooked by Olber's paradox, and we would need to know what fueled the stars. If the stars simply formed hot at some point in the past, then they would eventually cool off, and we'd freeze to death at the end of the universe instead. We were starting to get a decent idea how old Earth was then, too. This is when we start getting the first formal scientific theories for the beginning and ending of the universe, as we had to wrangle with these new issues and an increasingly large map of the universe. Keep in mind at this point we had no idea what powered the stars, how old any of them were, or that they had different ages, or what galaxies were. Everybody knew the problems with the static universe model, the one that reasoned the universe was infinite in size and age. But it was sort of the default because alternatives had many problems too, and none had any real evidence. Indeed, Einstein would offer up a modified form of the static universe model in 1917, a decade after he unveiled special relativity. As mentioned, many had thought the universe might be finite in age, but infinite in size. But he went the other way and said it was infinite in age, but finite in size. This is also when we start seeing folks talk about the universe having curvature or being flat. No surprise, since relativity had started the conversation on space and time being curved. In a traditional Euclidean universe, two long parallel lines stretching out to infinity will remain the same distance, like a pair of railroad tracks. For although they look like they're converging to our eyes, you can walk alongside them and see them remain the exact same distance apart. In a non-flat universe, this isn't true. They might grow closer together or further apart, even though they are 100% straight. That's not our focus yet, and we didn't know that the universe was expanding yet either. Now, what was different that Einstein thought the universe would be infinite in size, but not in time? There was no Hubble redshift yet to indicate that, after all. This is, incidentally, related to what Einstein called his biggest blunder, and that was the cosmological constant, a basic energy density or pressure to space, even in total vacuum. As mentioned, if the universe is finite in size, then gravity should yank everything together. So if it is finite in size, either gravity had to disappear after a certain distance, or the universe couldn't be that old and had to start big, or something was pushing them apart. We had gotten enough astronomy by now to be able to see stars pulling on each other with gravity, with no indication it was weakening more than Newton said it should, so that seemed out. So if it was infinitely old, something had to be pushing those stars apart, and that was the ridiculous cosmological constant, his fudge factor and blunder that he dismissed after Hubble expansion was found a decade later. We had to bring it back more recently, but we'll get to that later.
For Einstein's version of the static universe to be true, it needs to explain a few things, but we only knew of one at the time he suggested it, and that was entropy. Any model suggesting the universe was infinitely old, has always been and would always be, has to explain why we still have stars and what's replenishing their fuel. Or if not replenishing them, what was producing the matter for new stars and what was happening to the old, cold, dead ones, which should otherwise accumulate to fill the whole universe over infinite time. This is hardly a death blow, though, since one can assume matter eventually resets, like shuffling a deck of cards will keep further randomizing it, increasing its entropy, but eventually return you to the original state, resetting that entropy. And possibly new matter just appeared from nowhere and old matter just slid into nowhere on a regular basis. Sounds a bit silly, but considering the alternative is that it all just appeared from nowhere at the same time, it's essentially on the same footing. It's kind of hard to say tons of matter can appear from nowhere at one initial moment, but that can't do that later on, nor the reverse, and just disappear.
The other two flaws came later. One was intergalactic redshift, which came up shortly after this and caused Einstein to abandon the model, and the other was cosmic microwave background radiation, which was still about 50 years off. Hubble didn't discover redshift of stars, that had already been noted. Some were redshifting, indicating they were moving away, and others were blue shifting, indicating the reverse. What got noticed is that very distant objects, galaxies, were almost all redshifting, and that the further off they were, the more they were. This, of course, was the origin of the Big Bang Theory, since if galaxies are all moving away, and faster the further off they were, that would imply they used to be a lot closer. This was the exact opposite of the problem with the static universe, which assumed the universe needed to be bigger in the past if it were not either infinite in size or had some force keeping stars from falling together. Its big rival for quite some time was the steady state model that evolved from the static universe version. They are not the same, and folks often incorrectly assume steady state is the old model that the Big Bang replaced. Rather, the steady state model was proposed in 1948, a couple decades after the Big Bang theory. In the steady state model, we already knew that stars formed and were fueled and died, and we could see that intergalactic redshift. So it suggests the fuel for stars is constantly appearing in little bits and pieces, and that the universe is indeed expanding, but remains essentially the same and has always been and will always be. That's not as contradictory as it maybe sounds, and in a non-expanding universe, you end up with a clutter of dead stars, as new matter appears to make new stars. But if it's constantly expanding, then you have new room for stuff to be. And again, the notion that single particles of hydrogen are emerging from nowhere is no worse than new bits of space emerging from nowhere constantly, which both Big Bang and steady state claim happens, or that all that hydrogen emerged in one single flash of a moment. Now, you might be thinking you'd be able to detect new bits of matter emerging all over the place, but keep in mind that our sun has several cubic light years to itself and several billion years of life. So the 10 to the power of 57 AMU of mass, or hydrogen particles, making up a new one, would only require 10 to the 40th of them emerge each second and spread over some 10 to the 49th cubic meters, or one appearing every second in a cubic kilometer. Needless to say, spotting a single hydrogen atom appearing in a cubic kilometer in a given second is not exactly easy to do, especially back then. So Big Bang says all the matter appeared at once many billions of years ago, but space is constantly expanding. Steady state argues matter is constantly appearing, and so is space. There's no problem, by the way, with an infinite object expanding. Twice of infinity is still infinity, but it can get bigger. And indeed, that's permitted under the Big Bang, too, which just says those parts of the universe close enough for us to see used to be finite in size or even point-like. We don't know that the whole universe might not be infinite in size, and might have begun that way too. We just know it's much bigger than the parts we can see, and that those used to be way smaller. So throughout the 1940s and 50s, both models were quite popular with scientists. The first hard hit to steady state was the discovery of quasars, which in general are much more common the further from Earth you get, which means they were much more common in the past. They don't get less common closer to Earth because our region of the universe had fewer of them, but rather because they are almost all gone these days, and we can only see the old ones because the light is just reaching us. In the steady state model, the universe is expanding and gaining new bits of matter, but is basically the same over time. So finding a feature of the universe that has significantly changed over time strongly implies the universe is not steady and stable in its composition over time. So by the time we discovered cosmic microwave background radiation in 1964, steady state had already become the minority view of cosmologists, though still had a number of supporters. Initially, it wasn't too bad a blow, as one plausible explanation could be that it was light from ancient stars that had been scattered around by galactic dust. However, as we mapped it out better, it became increasingly clear that it was evenly spread in all directions, so whatever was causing it had nothing to do with our galaxy.
When the universe was a good deal younger and a good deal more dense, basically a big hot plasma, light was constantly being emitted by it, but scattering right away. Just one big white-hot fog of hydrogen plasma. As the universe expanded, it cooled. It eventually cooled enough to allow protons and electrons to bond to form neutral hydrogen gas instead, which no longer interacted with all that light as easily. That light took off in every direction without constantly slamming into things and scattering. For the first time, the universe became transparent. The light was emitted all across the universe, sailing off in all directions, and is now, 13.8 billion years later, arriving at every spot of space, since you can always draw a sphere around any given object, like Earth, that is just wide enough for light from that moment to be arriving. We call this the surface of last scattering, and expect it to keep getting bigger and weaker till the end of time. Nowadays, it's microwaves, hence cosmic microwave background radiation, or CMB. In the past, it was stronger infrared waves. Long down the road, it'll be weaker radio waves.
That was predictable by the Big Bang Theory, but not by steady state or static models, so it didn't quite kill them, but it locked the Big Bang in as the overwhelming consensus model. It still isn't the only one, and it predicts multiple possible ends for the universe, from Big Rip to Big Crunch, but it's essentially the state of play for the last several decades till now, and still running strong. We'll be exploring those scenarios and some more evidence for the Big Bang in Part 2, and some more modern competing theories, but as I said, steady state didn't die entirely, and indeed we got something called the quasi-steady state model, or QSS, in the early 90s, which adjusted steady state to include mini-bangs, for instance. Instead of matter appearing in bits and pieces constantly, it pops up in Big Bang events scattered far apart in time, but more like raindrops falling on a pond. Issues with this include why we can't see stuff older than the Big Bang, or local mini-bang, but indeed we often have had objects or structures that at least initially appeared older than the universe. This was particularly popular in what is called plasma cosmology, a theory of modest popularity in the 80s and 90s that was a variation on steady state in the sense of the universe having always been and always being, with no end. Like many such models, it didn't handle things like quasars or cosmic microwave background radiation very well. But as we reached more modern times, we also had to deal with both dark matter and dark energy, and we'll look at the impact of those as we move into Part 2. Just follow the link to Part 2 over on Paul Sutter's channel. We'll be back again next week to discuss de-extinction of species and high-tech ecosystem preservation. For alerts when that and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. And don't forget to subscribe to Paul's channel while you're over there for Part 2, and hit the like button for both episodes. We'll see you next week.
Welcome to a very special edition of Ask a Spaceman. Not only special because I gave my chalkboard its annual cleaning and it's still drying, but because this is a part two of a collaboration with Isaac Arthur called Compendium of Doom. If you haven't already seen part one, there is a link down there. You should probably watch it, otherwise this part is not going to make any sense at all. And, you know, there's a good chance this won't make sense anyway, but definitely part one is going to help. So, click that link if you already haven't watched part one. Don't worry, I'll wait here for you. All right, welcome back. Now, in that episode, in part one, Isaac and I talked about how the Big Bang Theory came to be, how it became the dominant theory of cosmology of the history and evolution of our universe. But that's the past. And I want to talk about the future. And talking about the future in cosmology is actually pretty straightforward. It's a pretty simple game. Not necessarily an easy game, but a simple game. And that simple game is because of general relativity. We use general relativity to understand the evolution of the universe. And general relativity is very, very simple. You connect the matter and energy contents in a system, whether that system is the solar system or around a black hole or a galaxy or the universe itself, you connect the matter and energy contents to the geometric curvature of that system. And then that geometric curvature tells us how the matter and energy contents move around. This applies in the solar system, around black holes, around galaxies, and in the universe itself. That's why you may have heard, if you've read up on future fates of the universe, things like closed or flat or open universes. These refer to geometries. These refer to how parallel lines will behave on the very, very largest scales. And we're interested in that because the geometry of the universe tells us about what the universe is made of, and vice versa. And those two together tell us how the universe will evolve. So, for example, if there's a lot of stuff in the universe, if we're just overflowing with matter, then the gravitational attraction of that matter is enough to eventually halt our current era of expansion and reverse it and crunch the universe back down. That is a fate of the universe called Big Crunch, and that the geometry that connects to that is called closed geometry. Likewise, if there's not enough stuff in the universe, if there's only a little bit of matter floating around, then it can never halt the expansion, and expansion will continue to accelerate forever. We call that an open universe. Geometry is connected to contents. And then there's the third possibility, which is the most interesting, which is the case of what's called a flat universe, where parallel lines stay perfectly parallel through all of space and time. And in this case, there's just enough matter to overcome expansion, so the expansion will slow down and coast to a stop. Technically, it'll take an infinite amount of time to actually reach velocity zero, so it's always kind of expanding, but the expansion rate is always slowing down. That's the fate of a flat universe. And in the 90s, there were huge debates among astronomers and cosmologists about what the universe was made of, what its curvature was, and what its ultimate fate was. These were all the same questions. They were all interconnected. One group of astronomers, one group of observations was saying there's not enough stuff. We live in an open universe. It's going to continue expanding forever. But another set of observations, mostly based on the cosmic microwave background, was saying, no, the universe is flat. We're actually right on that line. So yeah, it will continue expanding, but it will slow down as time goes on. And this was, I can't even begin to describe how big of a debate this was in the cosmological and astronomical community, because we had two sets of observations that did not agree with each other. And Isaac Arthur is about to tell us about an interesting discovery that made all the observations agree with each other and totally set the stage for a brand new paradigm. So take it away, Isaac.
Probably the biggest development in terms of us discovering how the universe will end in the last few decades was dark energy. We already knew the universe was expanding and something had to be driving that, but in the late 1990s, we began getting a very large collection of distant supernovae. Supernovae come in a variety of forms and are so bright they can be seen in distant galaxies, but one of those types, Type 1A, which is when a white dwarf remnant detonates after accumulating material from a binary companion, releases a very characteristic blast in terms of energy and profile. By gathering up dozens of these events, we could chart out how far away they were and how much they were redshifting, how fast they are moving away from us. This lets us get a fairly accurate measurement of how quickly the universe was expanding, and we found to our surprise that the expansion wasn't remaining constant, or even slowing down as we'd expect if gravity were tugging on such galaxies and pulling them back, potentially causing an eventual big crunch, but rather that cosmic expansion was actually speeding up. Accelerating expansion causes some serious problems for virtually every prior cosmological model discussing the eventual fate of the universe, and also introduced the possibility that it might keep getting faster and faster, and eventually rip apart even galaxies, stars, or possibly even atoms themselves. This model, the Big Rip, which we'll get into in a bit, represents an entirely new end for the universe, being shredded down to subatomic particles.
Thanks, Isaac. That's a great summary of this major discovery of dark energy, the name we give to the accelerated expansion of the universe. We live in a universe with dark energy. We can't escape that observational fact. We live in a universe with accelerated expansion. It is totally flat. It's totally flat, but the expansion of the universe is accelerating. What does this mean for the long-term fate of our universe? Well, let's start talking about what we can see. What we can see. You know, we see stars in the sky, we see nearby galaxies, and then we see very, very distant galaxies. And to live in an expanding universe, it means that every galaxy gets further away from every other galaxy. It also means that the further away a galaxy already is, the faster it appears to recede from us. And that means eventually you reach a point, like, you know, if a galaxy is twice as far away, it's receding twice as fast, four times as far, four times as fast, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually you reach a point where there are galaxies, distant galaxies, they're receding so fast, they're receding faster than the speed of light. No, that's not a problem, but that's another episode to talk about that. What it means is that these galaxies are outside of causal contact. It means we cannot ever touch those galaxies. We can build the biggest, baddest rocket ship you can possibly imagine, blast off as fast as you can go. You will never, ever catch up with that galaxy. But we see it because the light from that galaxy left the galaxy a long time ago. And we're just seeing the image. It's like we're getting a postcard of that galaxy, but that galaxy has already crossed across the ocean. It's already in another country. It's already on vacation. It's not calling. It's not picking up its phone. It cut itself. It's off the grid. It's not talking to us, but we got a postcard from when it left. And this sphere of the galaxies that we have causal contact with, like if we really, really wanted to, we could reach out and go to Andromeda. It'd be super hard, but we could do it. The most distant galaxies that we can see, we can never visit them. And that sphere grows smaller and smaller and smaller as the expansion of the universe accelerates. It pulls these galaxies outside of causal contact, outside of our bubble that we're allowed to affect. And it also means that the light from the galaxies that we still can see gets redshifted, gets stretched more and more. So right now we look around, we see galaxies in visible light. The most distant galaxies are already more shifted into the infrared. And if you've ever wondered why James Webb Space Telescope is going to be an infrared telescope, that's exactly why, but that's another episode too. Feel free to ask. And given time, say, I don't know, hundreds of billions of years, these galaxies will stretch out even more. The light from the galaxies will stretch out even more, where they'll go down into the radio. And then they'll be emitting light that the wavelength is equal to like the width of the observable universe, which means you can't see it at all. And that means galaxies disappear. Galaxies disappear. So even though the universe is getting bigger with time, our observable patch is getting smaller. All that will be left will be what's called the local group of galaxies. And Isaac's going to come back to tell us what's going to happen to those remnants.
As we discussed in part one, one of the flaws of most early cosmological models developed after Newton's law of gravity was that only in an infinite universe would material fail to fall together from gravity over time. While cosmic expansion mostly dealt with that issue, it remains the case that gravity is a strictly attractive force, and at a galactic scale, is pulling all the stars and neighboring galaxies together. Our own galaxy is quite the cannibal, and eaten many smaller galaxies down the eons, and of the 54 galaxies in what we call the local group, only Andromeda matches us in size, and these two galaxies form the approximate middle of the local group. Those galaxies which are gravitationally bound together, and which we expect to stay that way, rather than flying away as more further ones do. You've probably heard that we are set to merge with Andromeda in a few billion years, but indeed we should end up merging with all of them as one massive galaxy. In fact, there's a chance that the third largest galaxy in the local group, the Triangulum Galaxy, might end up merging with the Milky Way or Andromeda before they do, and won't be far behind. The rest of the galaxies in the group will slowly be eaten up too, and on a timeline fairly close to when all other galaxies beyond the local group will have fled beyond the cosmological horizon from expansion, leaving just one supergalaxy in the ocean of the night. While this is a long while off, it will occur long before star formation rates have begun dropping off. Most stars and planets yet to be born will live and die in a period when there is only one giant galaxy and no others to be seen beyond.
Thanks again, Isaac. It's important to keep in mind that the timescales we're talking about now are ridiculously long. I mean, hundreds of billions of years long. The universe has only been around for 13.8 billion years. And this, we're talking about hundreds of billions of years. So multiple times longer than the universe has already existed. Long after our sun is already dead. These are the processes that are taking place. Galaxies, distant galaxies will be ripped from view. Anything that's not in the local group, gone. See you later. Never going to see you again. And then the galaxies that do remain in our local group, like Isaac said, are all going to merge together into one big, messy clump of galaxy. Over those same time scales, the stars that make up that galaxy are going to shift character because stars are going to die off. Stars are going to die off because in order to make a star, you need enough gas, dust, stuff to squeeze down into a very dense point such that nuclear fusion ignites. That's a pretty rare circumstance. And in an old universe that's cooler, that's thinner, that's less dense, those opportunities aren't going to be as common. Get this. We're already past the peak of star formation. Already, today, right now, there are fewer stars being born every year in our universe than there were 5 billion years ago. We're already past the peak, and it's only downhill from here. And the stars that do get made, they won't be the big blue white stars. They won't even be stars like our own sun. There just isn't enough material left. It will be the small red dwarfs that will be manufactured. And this means that at a certain point, the last star in the universe will be born. We're not exactly sure. It's a little bit tough because, you know, this is pretty complicated physics, predicting star formation right in the distant future. Somewhere between 1 and 100 trillion years from now. Somewhere between 1 and 100 trillion years from now, the last star will be born. It will be a small red dwarf star. It will have a lifetime of, you know, 10 or 20 trillion years. These small stars can live very, very long times. But now we're talking about long times, so it doesn't really matter. Somewhere around 120 trillion years from now, the last star will die. The last star will die. Nuclear fusion will cease. There will still be random collisions of brown dwarfs or neutron stars where you'll temporarily get enough mass to reignite nuclear fusion somewhere like 100 at any given time in the remnants of the merged galaxy. 100 trillion years from now, 200 trillion years from now, there might be 100 stars shining, tops. But for all intents and purposes, after 120 trillion years, it's the end of the star-forming region, star-forming time, epoch, era in our universe. After that, we pass into what we call the degenerate era. So this current era that we live in now is known as the stelliferous era, the star-forming era. And then we pass into the degenerate era. It's just the leftovers. It's white dwarfs, which, by the way, have now cooled down to close to absolute zero, so they're more like black dwarfs. There's neutron stars. There's black holes. There's the never-got-to-be planet, so there's still clouds of gas and dust hanging around. There's planets themselves. There's brown dwarfs. It's just a dim, cold, empty universe that doesn't have a lot of light, doesn't have a lot of warmth. And over the next tens of quintillions of years, now we're going to ridiculously long time scales, you have this dead, decaying lump of a galaxy that's all isolated, all completely isolated in its universe. It can't see any other galaxy. There'll be chance interactions, like two failed stars, two brown dwarfs might come pass by each other, and one might get a kick, enough energy to kick it out of the galaxy. Once it's outside the galaxy, then it's gone. Because outside of the gravitational bubble of our own galaxy, the rest of the universe is completely and totally dominated by dark energy. So once that escapes, that accelerated expansion rips it apart. And one by one by one, every macroscopic object in our galaxy evaporates. It leaves. It gets kicked out just by chance interactions. It takes an incredibly long amount of time, tens of quintillions of years, which is a long time, but it's bound to happen. Anything that doesn't get kicked out, maybe like 10% or so survives all these interactions, they'll eventually accrete down into the central supermassive black hole. And so that all that will be left in our own spot in the galaxy will be the central supermassive black hole. All other macroscopic objects get isolated into their own little bubble universes, carried away by accelerated expansion. That means if you were somehow still alive and somehow still sitting on a planet, well, there'd be no star, there'd be no sun in your sky, there would be no other stars, there would be no other galaxies, there would be no nebula, you would be barely above absolute zero, you would be completely and totally isolated in your universe. Nothing else. you wouldn't even know that this current epoch, the epoch we live in the universe, even happened. You would look around, you'd see your heavy elements. You know, you'd have your iron, your carbon. You'd wonder how iron and carbon got here. Huh. But it's too cold for, like, nuclear fusion, and, you know, there's not enough gravitating objects. You wouldn't know. You just wouldn't know. That's the crazy part. In the far distant future, you wouldn't even know the current era, like, existed. There'd be nothing left. After 10 to the 30 years, this is when each macroscopic object essentially sits in its own bubble universe, its own observable bubble. And then it gets weird. It gets weird because macroscopic objects themselves, over these incredible timescales, start to break down. They break down because at the fundamental level, at the microscopic level, things are ruled. Physics is ruled by quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is all about probabilities and chance. Usually we don't worry about that. But if you give an object, 10 to the 30 or 40, 50, 10 to the 100 years, weird stuff is bound to happen. Like, a little molecule just might spontaneously disassociate, because why not? Or a proton might just leave an atomic nucleus and decay, and then it becomes unstable and keeps decaying. Macroscopic objects will just dissolve. And at the extreme long end of the universe, far, far distant timescales, the universe is just fundamental particles. Black holes are going to evaporate through Hawking radiation. Give them enough time and they will. Neutron stars are going to dissolve. White dwarfs / black dwarfs are going to dissolve. The planets are going to dissolve. And you're just left with a cold, thin, expanding soup of fundamental particles, of photons, electrons, neutrinos. That's it. And then each one of those eventually gets ripped apart by this ridiculous accelerated expansion of dark energy. And it's just one electron in its own little universe over here, one photon over here in its own little universe, one neutrino over here in its own little universe. That's it, slowly approaching absolute zero. We call this the heat death of the universe, because as time goes on, temperature differences go to zero and everything cools to absolute zero. And with no heat differences, there's no work that can be done. No thermodynamic exchange, which means no chemistry, no interesting physics, no neurological processes. So it really is like a death, because like nothing can happen. If there's no heat differences, then nothing can happen physically, fundamentally physically. And I know that's kind of sad. It's like a bummer outlook. Thankfully, it's like way far in the future. And like I said, this is the most likely scenario. This is what we know based on our current understanding of physics, based on our current understanding of what dark energy and dark matter is, like what our universe is made of. And there are some other possibilities. There are some other possibilities because we're not exactly sure what dark energy is going to do, because we haven't totally really measured it very well. One possibility that might change this outcome is that if dark energy actually increases with time. Right now we think it's constant, the acceleration of the universe is constant, but what if the acceleration itself gets worse and worse? That means that not only will distant galaxies get ripped apart from us, it will also eventually overwhelm our local group. It will eventually overwhelm our own galaxy. It will eventually overwhelm solar systems, molecular bonds, atomic bonds, nuclear bonds. As that acceleration keeps ramping up, the universe just rips itself apart. And we call this the Big Rip. And if that happens, if that is the outcome of our universe, this can happen on relatively quick timescales, somewhere around 10 billion years. Which is like nothing compared to the heat death, where we had like 10 to the 30, 10 to the 100 years to work stuff out. 10 billion years is nothing. That means we're already halfway to the end of the universe, which is kind of difficult to think about. Again, we're not sure because we haven't measured dark energy well enough to know if it really is constant or if it's changing with time. Or because we don't fully understand dark energy, we don't know what it's made of, it could transform itself. Whatever's powering the accelerated expansion could just transform, maybe flood the universe with a new set of particles, maybe do something else. We're not exactly sure. Isaac's going to come back one last time to share with us what that might entail. Take it away, Isaac.
While we have had many a model for the end of the universe get expunged, with overwhelming evidence against, and many more developed, one of the most popular of these was the Big Crunch, the notion that gravity would eventually slow down cosmic expansion and drag everything back together again, ending the universe as a super-hot and compact, fiery death. A variation of this called the Big Bounce explores a cyclical approach, where it crunches all the way back down to a point and then explodes as a new Big Bang. Rinse and repeat. While the accelerating expansion evidence would at first seem to kill the Big Crunch off as a theory, it has gotten some second looks. Just as the Big Rip suggests dark energy could push apart even faster and grow stronger and stronger till it rips apart even atoms, it is possible it could fall off over time. Should it weaken, we get the opposite of the Big Rip, a slowdown and potential eventual collapse, Big Crunch 2.0. In such a model, the collapsing universe would heat up as it collapsed, potentially allowing us to tap that contraction for energy to run civilizations up till nearly the end. Of course, a lot of this depends on the concept of vacuum energy, something we still don't understand too well, and it offers us one last option for the fate of the universe, that we might simply undergo vacuum decay and pop right out of existence.
So like Isaac said, the future fate of the universe depends, really critically depends, on what dark energy is going to do. And since we don't fully understand dark energy, we don't fully understand the fate of the universe. What I outline, the heat death, is if dark energy stays constant. But even then, there are some escape hatches. Some escape hatches. Like, if you give a random patch of the universe that's complete and total vacuum, we know that there's zero point energy, that it's vibrating with the fundamental quantum fields, there's this base energy to the universe. If you give it long enough, like, I don't know, 10 to 100 years or whatever, it just might randomly fluctuate, so like, and spawn a new Big Bang. A new epoch of inflation. Maybe, kind of, sort of, it's kind of hard to tell. In that case, the universe would continue just based on these random fluctuations that each child universe eventually peters out, but give it a long enough time, it'll spawn a new universe. Maybe, kind of, sort of. Maybe the death of the universe is a little bit more exotic. Maybe our current universe isn't in its ground state. Maybe our current universe, with our current set of four forces and particles and fields that make up physics as we know it, maybe that's not the most stable configuration. Maybe that's not the most stable configuration. Maybe the universe just might turn over, might become, there might be some little bubble, a little fizz that knocks the universe over until it finds its true ground state, its true minimum, its true most stable configuration. We think the universe looks pretty stable. It's been like this for 13.8 billion years, but you never know. Maybe it's metastable. Maybe it's only kind of sort of stable, and you just need something to jolt it. And in that case, there'd be a random spot in the universe, maybe more than one, that would randomly transform, settle into its new ground state, and outwardly expand. There'd be an outwardly expanding sphere at the speed of light, where inside the bubble is a completely new universe with new forces, new particles, new fields, a whole deal, all new physics, and all new chemistry and all new kinds of life. And outside the bubble is our normal everyday universe. We can't see it coming because it's advancing at the speed of light until it, that's it. We call that vacuum decay. Again, we're not exactly sure because we don't know if our current vacuum is stable, if our current universe arrangement is stable. I don't know. who knows? I'm like that's the fun part of talking about the end state of the universe is there's so many possibilities and they're based on things we can measure. If we measure dark energy better, if we measure the same things like the Higgs boson better, we can understand if our universe will undergo vacuum decay. We can understand if the Big Rip scenario is likely or not. That's what's so exciting. We get to talk about stuff that's going to happen tens of quintillions of years from now by doing measurements today. So that's our compendium of doom. If you haven't already watched part one, go to Isaac Arthur's channel. There's a link right there. It's called Science and Futurism. Fabulous channel. You should give it a try.
If you've already seen that, don't forget to like and subscribe to both channels.
And I'm Paul Sutter. Thank you again for watching.
And this is Isaac Arthur. Thanks for joining us.
And we'll see you next time.